Welcome to the Monday Morning Pastor. This podcast is brought to you by Kairos Partnerships. JR, good morning.
Good morning, Doug. Always great to see you, brother.
Yeah, man. I kind of wish we were doing an episode of the crap in your office, but I mean the stuff in your office, but it's been a long time and it just doesn't feel the same when I can't touch it.
Well, there's always stuff accumulating in my office. I'm not sure if it's worth talking about or not, but sometimes it feels like just stacks of papers and books everywhere. But
is that a holy dust bunny I see in the corner?
Dust bunny, not sure it's holy.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, so we started something just last month. We started thinking through quotes and questions. And so we'll get into that in just a moment. But with Advent being pretty much full tilt, how have you been experiencing Jesus in this season?
Great question. Using the elements, you know, hope and peace and joy and love, just thinking through those, it's been interesting in our house churches our house church model that we have in our church. With our house church, we've just been talking about, people saying hope, how do you hope in the midst of a year like 2020? How do you find joy in the midst of a year like 2020? How do we find peace in a year that's been so uncertain? So it's been really interesting. I think people are reflecting to a level about Advent more than almost any year in the past. So I think there's probably more questions than answers. And I think that may be part of what Advent is about. We sing Silent Night, Holy Night, like this peaceful, calm thing. But to realize the terror that was happening in Bethlehem around the time of Jesus's birth, right? You've got a tyrant in Herod that lives 6 miles away in Jerusalem, and all the baby boys under two are murdered. And so just what is that like for Mary to walk through the market and to see other moms that she knows through mops, or whatever, that lost their children, their sons. I'm not sure it was a silent night. It might have been a holy night, but I'm not sure it was a silent night. Babies cry, women in labor scream, they're exhausted. So, and it's just kind of returning to kind of the stains on our hands when we think about Advent. It's been a little bit dirtier and grittier this year. Mm-hmm. But I think in a more humane and human way. So that's what's been rolling around in my head during this Advent season. How about you, Doug?
Very similar, JR, for me too. It feels like a very real season. And I think having opportunity to reflect while wearing the lenses of 2020 has really been a challenge. I feel like the shepherds being terrified of good news coming, and just even realizing that there has just been such a shift in my own soul of seeing this story as very human. And I love the way you frame, the loudness of mothers crying and, child labor is not a quiet thing, but even from the perspective of like, just noticing the invitation to slow down because we're kind of forced to. I've really enjoyed that. And I think for me specifically, it's been great walking in the mornings and just noticing the sun coming up and life beginning again anew. It feels like that. The darkness feels extra dark this year and the light feels extra bright this year. And I think that contrast is a lot larger. And so, yeah, I feel like I'm meeting God in the midst of that contrast, in the tension. I agree. I feel like I've probably have looked at these passages with much more question asking than just the nostalgia of what normal Advent may look like from time to time. And so, and I've also been engaging a couple different Advent reading plans, like the Biola has a great Advent calendar with art and music. There was an album that they had a couple, I think it was the first or second day, but it was this really, really fantastic group called Common Hymnal. And there was a song in there that just was just exciting. Like it, I noticed my soul leaping off the page as it was, or leaping just off of, out of my chest as I was thinking through like, man, what this implies. So yeah, I also noticed just his tenderness. I feel like God's been very tender in this season and patient, and I'm grateful for that.
That's great. Yeah. You know, one thing, even just the last couple mornings, thinking about John the Baptist, I'm not sure we highlight John the Baptist as much as he deserves during Advent, right? I mean, this is a season of preparation. What did John do? He prepared the way. And so I've just been trying to focus more and more on who is John the Baptist and what is his role. And we sort of think of him as this kind of freaky guy who lived out in the wilderness and ate weird things and wore strange clothes. And, you know, it sounds like a hipster. Maybe it was just first century hipster. I don't know. But one of the things that struck me is why is it that John the Baptist knows who Jesus is and tells others about him, yet he never becomes a disciple of Jesus himself?
Ooh.
And so I've just been wondering, what implications does this have for us today in our world, that he knew maybe more than most people who Jesus was? Was it because it was a relative? You know, is that kind of a weird family dynamic to be, you know, a disciple to a rabbi who's also your cousin? You know, like that's, you know, anyway, yeah. I just have wondered why he did not actually become one of his disciples.
Yeah. I love, is it the earliest recorded issue that we have with nepotism where it was actually healthy?
Fascinating.
That's a really interesting question.
Yeah. So I know that, you mentioned at the top that we've been doing this idea of questions and quotes. And so Doug, I'm curious, what's a quote that's been rolling around in your head and your heart recently you want to share?
Yeah. So I've been reading a lot of David Benner recently. And he started his book with this quote by Thomas Merton. And man, it's just been rattling in my soul. But there is only one problem on which all my existence, my peace, and my happiness depend: to discover myself in discovering God. If I find him, I will find myself. And if I find my true self, I will find him. And I've just been thinking a lot about that over the last few weeks and months, especially in this season, because I get this sense of there's a lot that's exposed in our personhood in the season like we're in. And I want to find God in those really rough spaces. And so I've just been encouraged by that. I feel like I've been challenged by that. And also I've really seen God show up in some pretty cool ways. So
yeah, that's great.
How about you?
Well, I actually want to read a brief poem. And look, I know two dudes sitting around reciting poetry may not be, you know, the coolest thing, but it's from my favorite American living poet by the name of Billy Collins. Billy Collins was actually appointed as the poet laureate of the United States for a couple of years. I think it was 2001 to 2003, but poet laureate. So basically our country's greatest poet is basically what that role is. But he's written several that are just zingers. And this is a short one, but it's called Flock. And I think it relates quite well to this idea of the Lamb of God and thinking about this time of year, this season of Advent. But it's called Flock. And at the beginning, Billy Collins says, "It has been calculated that each copy of the Gutenberg Bible required the skins of 300 sheep." And he said it's from an article on printing. He said, "I can see them squeezed into the holding pen behind the stone building where the printing press is housed, all of them squirming around to find a little room and looking so much alike. It would be nearly impossible to count them, and there is no telling which one will carry the news that the Lord is a shepherd, one of the few things they already know." I find that so moving. Maybe I'll read it one more time, because I've always been told by my English teacher growing up, you always read poetry slowly, you always read it aloud, and you always read it twice. So, Flock by Billy Collins. "It has been calculated that each copy of the Gutenberg Bible required the skins of 300 sheep." This is from an article on printing. "I can see them squeezed into the holding pen behind the stone building where the printing press is housed, all of them squirming around to find a little room and looking so much alike. It would be nearly impossible to count them, and there is no telling which one will carry the news that the Lord is a shepherd, one of the few things they already knew."
Dang, dude.
That's so anyway, good. Yeah, I just love Billy Collins. There's so many good ones, but I thought that was appropriate for Advent. So,
yes.
And then the yes. question that I'm thinking through is like, just a very simple one. Am I living out of an overflow model or out of a depletion model? Yeah. Is it a model of overflow or a model of depletion, of just saying like ministry is done out of the overflow of what God's doing in my soul and in my life? Or am I just saying I'm so exhausted, I just have to get through today. I just have to do all I can to kind of hang in there because ministry's hard and ministry's tiring. So one is a kind of a scarcity mindset. One is an abundance mindset. So yeah. That's a question I've been thinking through that I want to extend to our listeners as well. So
that's great. Yeah. The question I've been thinking through is, I've been thinking through this question and asking to others, but even as I've been fucking for myself, tell your story. Can you tell your story using only the highlights? Mm. And so I think in some ways very similar, just wanting to highlight the moments where I've seen like the goodness and the good things, not to erase the hard stuff, but just to notice the highlights of one story. I don't know. Maybe the follow-up question I'll be wrestling with in the next month is, can I tell my story with only the lowlights?
Yeah, and just fascinating.
Thinking through how those things really play off one another.
Yeah. Or is it even possible? I don't know. I haven't thought about that. Like, are all stories of highlights and lowlights. Yeah. Wow. Those are very thoughtful.
Yeah. So,
well, we're looking forward to this interview coming up here. And man, I think this is going to be a good one. It's a good one kind of leaning into Christmas here. It may not be Christmas related, but I think it's a really good one for our pastors to reflect kind of going into these next few weeks, the last few weeks of the year before we tip into the new year. So hope you enjoy this interview. Brian, welcome to the Monday Morning Pastor Podcast. We're really glad you could join us this morning.
Thanks, man. It's good to see your smiling faces and hear you.
Yeah. Well, I know that you and a team of people developed and cultivated this new form, this new expression of church in Tampa called the Underground Network. Tell us briefly about the story of the Underground Network, and I'm even the meaning, the origin of the name. I'd be very curious for you to unpack that a little bit.
Man, nobody asked me that. That's cool. the Underground did start as a kind of protest, I guess you could say. We were frustrated, with kind of our experience in the traditional form of church. We're missionary people, living, doing ministry in the inner city, working on college campuses, parachurch, that kind of thing. So I was actually studying. So I have two advanced degrees, and my second was in London. And so I was spending quite a bit of time in London and just kind of blown away by that whole underground train system, the tube. And
I wondered if there was a connection to that.
Yeah. And it's like this city underneath the city. It's like this invisible city that makes that city possible. Like London doesn't work without the underground. There's just no way for it to happen. But it's like humble, it's a modest kind of infrastructure. And in some cases it goes really deep. If you've been there, those escalators go way the heck down into the earth, it's just a profound amount of work, but with no grandiosity, this city underneath the city. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, the name is also a tribute to the underground church in history, which is, it's an homage, like the church maybe, well, from our point of view, the church is at its best, when it's persecuted and pressed down and kind of not in hiding, but also not like, well, Eugene Peterson said the church is at its best when it's a minority, when it's kind of speaking, the little guy speaking to power. And we don't do as well probably when we're in power, when we're actually given all the tools or whatever. So we like that. And the story of the underground, you know, in a nutshell, is essentially a group of about 50 people that felt that angst and that sense of like, surely there's more, surely we could do this differently or possibly even better. You know, the hubris of youth, you think you could do things better. Or at least, let's say it this way, at least we could do it in a way that was consistent with our own conscience and our own discipleship. So if we do make mistakes, at least they could be our mistakes. That's the problem with inheriting a system, isn't it? That you end up making other people's mistakes, you know, and you never agreed to them, you know, you're just sort of stuck in them. So at least if we're gonna do a form of church that was wrong, at least it could be our errors, you know, not somebody else's errors. So we took off. We went to the developing world. We spent almost a year in Manila, Philippines, living in the slums, and just tried to seek God and learn from Filipinos who were working with the poor. To kind of create a different kind of church. And the manifesto, our sort of 18 values, which is the glue that holds the whole community together. The network is essentially held together, not by a vision, but by these values, was developed there. So born there, in the midst of that time. I guess practically speaking, it's a decentralized network of micro churches, you know, so people need to feel called by God to do something in mission, form community around that calling and around that mission. We call that the church. Mm-hmm. And then we formed an ecclesial entity to support, reinforce, celebrate, and serve that. And that's it. I mean, it's complicated because we had to re-engineer everything: money, governance, leadership, ordination, our relationship to contracts and facilities, and is like all brand new. You know, so if you start with this bias towards mission and towards personal calling, well, then what would the church look like? How would you do governance, for example? You know, how would you talk about leadership? How would you handle money? What would a budget look like? What would staffing that or serving that look like? It'd be different. So, but you know, we had to kind of start from scratch on all those things. But essentially, that's what it is.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that I love about the way you think, Brian, are your metaphors and the illustrations you use when you're writing or when you're teaching. And one of the things I chuckled when you talked about Netscape Navigator and that clunky, really buggy web browser. Talk about how you know Netscape Navigator and what is that? How does that relate to church and what you're doing with Underground?
Well, I just say we're like Netscape Navigator in the sense that in the early days of the internet, Netscape Navigator was the way that you got on the internet. It was one of the few ways you had to access this incredible thing. You know, it was the HTML, whatever portal. But where is it now? It's gone. Who cares? I mean, it's a starting point. And now, you know, whatever Edge, Chrome, these things, they come out of Netscape Navigator. So I've never said or thought the underground was some sort of empire model to be replicated. It feels more like you break ground and all of a sudden something different is possible. And that awakens the creativity in the field, in the industry, you know, in our case, in the people of God. And, you know, probably other people are going to do this form of kind of a dual operating system, decentralized with a centralized service platform, better than us. And it's going to improve. So I have no interest personally. I have no interest in seeing it replicated, but I have a lot of joy and a lot of hope that it will be improved upon. And one, you know, we'll have way better, you know, versions of it. And maybe the underground as a thing will just be like a story that we tell that happened a while ago, you know, and it's okay with me too, if it doesn't even, if it plays its part in history. That all sounds really awkward. This whole conversation sounds awkward, but, you know, it's not that serious. None of it is that serious, but yeah, Netscape Navigator's defunct web browser that was helpful for a minute. That's how about that?
Yeah. Yeah. Great.
I think that's really, it is really helpful too, but even just to have that idea of, you know, the, when you're thinking about missional models and what it looks like to be church, to do church. I just also appreciate kind of the, I guess your posture of like, man, if it can be approved upon, this isn't the, we didn't settle on this one thing. Like, this is how to do it. This is just what we know the Spirit kind of caught us with in the wind, and we've been able to take it here. And our hope is that other things move forward. Now, I want to just ask a question more around like, what does it look like for like your leadership structure? You know, you kind of talked a little bit about how when you do something like this, my sense is everything, there's a lot of unlearning that needs to take place. What are some of the things that you feel like you and your team had to unlearn?
Wow. Everything. I mean, you really do. I mean, so like our sort of middle class biases, you know, our whatever, you know, the bias toward the pastor teacher, not the apostolic, you know, the missionary person is kind of a crazy uncle, you know, trying to bring that person to the center. Honestly, guys, servant leadership, you know, like I read a lot. So I've probably read 1,000 books on leadership in my lifetime. And most of them promote a form of leadership, which is like anathema to Jesus, to scripture. You know, he said specifically, the Gentiles lead this way, not so with you. You guys, you cannot lead like this. And we do, and we have. And I learned, you know, through whatever osmosis, a certain way of leading, you know, singular leader at the top. It's lonely. You have to sort of bear the burden of leadership. You have to, you know, you have teams, but you just use those teams for your ends, for a vision that you have, mm-hmm. you know, the sort of great man myth, which has shaped so much of the narrative, the meta narrative, even of what leadership is in America. And this idea of servant leadership, which we talk about, we use that construct, but it's like not real. It's people, you know, our relationship to church leaders is often about what we're meant to do for them, what we're meant to come and somehow build, be a part of building for them. It's that sort of church's spectacle. You know, the job of a parishioner is to come and like participate in the programs or the budget or the vision of that particular church. And I just think that's a conflation more of culture than it is of probably of scripture. It's not all terrible or bad. It's not evil necessarily, but you know, that's something we really had to unlearn. Like how do we, not only we be servants, like at our core, like Robert Greenleaf in his like seminal book in the late 1960s wrote a book called Servant Leadership, not a Christian, you know, a prophetic, speaking into a very tumultuous time. The late 1960s reminds me of the last couple of years, you know, mm-hmm. and saying like what the world needs is natural servants who learn to lead, not leaders who learn to serve. Mm-hmm. You know, the kind of like Jesus CEO, Ken Blanchard stuff where you can teach servanthood as a tactic. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So to be a sort of successful leader, you need to convince people that you're there to serve them. Well, guys, that's demagoguery. Mm. So if it's a trick that you're playing on people, like if it's a tactic, then that's the opposite of servanthood. Actually, that becomes deception. You know, I'm overstating it, but you know, the idea of like natural servants that learn to lead, we'd much rather have that. Greenleaf said we'd much rather have that, and I think that's fundamental to the underground too. And us becoming like, us as not just staff, but as microchurch leaders, as elders, all that stuff, being like servants at our core first, and then also creating a infrastructure, which is which is a service platform. It's essentially it's servanthood built in. It can't not be servanthood. Like what drives it is to serve this group of people, you know? So there are many things like that, but that's a great example of like a profound unlearning that we had to do.
Yeah, that idea of servant leadership. I remember I had a mentor of mine at 23 years old. He looked at me and said, "You've heard servant leadership. JR, I want you to wrestle this week with, is it better to be a leader who serves or a servant who leads?" And he's like, "It's not nuance," but he's like, "Your answer will change the trajectory of your life." And so I would totally resonate with what you're talking about. Yeah, you know, going deeper with that, you said one of the things you wrote was perhaps we see so little engagement in the American church because we have not offered Christians an entry that is accessible to them. You talk in a couple of your books about the ecclesial minimum. Unpack the ecclesial minimum and even why that question of even on your grant application, I think is how is this about these three things? And if not, we can't say yes to it. Unpack those three for us here.
Yeah. I mean, in business terms, it'd be like the minimum viable product, you know, or like in Seth Godin's terms, you have to ship. So you can tweak a product all day long, but you got to figure out what is it in its essence and how quickly can we ship it? So if you care about something like church planting, so let's just say you think the church is a good thing and having more of them would be good for the world, you know, more of them in more places would be good for the world. Then the question is, okay, what is it actually like in its essence, at its core? I think it's the most profound question we can ask in the 21st century. Like, what is the church? Because we've assumed so much about it. We for the last 15 years, we just went crazy on church planting, but we didn't ask the core question, what are we planting? You know what I mean? We just went out and like replicated what we had, which is already behind in many ways to keep up with the context, you know? So I think asking that sort of minimum viable product or that irreducible minimum, or what we've called the ecclesial minimum, like what is the church where if you stripped everything away and you were only left with this, you'd still have to admit, yeah, that's a church, you know? And I don't know what it would be for you, but everybody has a minimum. I mean, even if it's 9 marks or 12 things or 7 sacraments or whatever your thing is, there's a number. Like, it's not as big as we think. It's not as complex as we think, that minimum thing. Now, it's not to say you could add to it and make it, you know, many other things or have many other parts. But what is it? So for us, it came to those three things, that sort of up in and out, the, you know, the vertical and the horizontal, like lordship of Jesus, worship of God. That's one. You know, community with other people who know Jesus or committed to that same lordship, and then mission, somehow expanding the boundaries of the kingdom to the poor, to the lost. That when those three things are happening at a place and time with a group of people, I think you're looking at the church. That would be our argument. Now, again, what is it for you? I don't know. But whatever it is, whatever you settle on, that ecclesial minimum you settle on, that's what you should plant. Mm-hmm. That's what you should replicate or multiply. And that doesn't cost $500,000 to do one, to plant one. And the end result being what a number I saw, it costs $1 million in the US to baptize one person.
Wow.
That's our ratio. So that approach or that model is very expensive. Because it's so complex and it's all tied up. You guys know this. It's all tied up in the kind of clergy class thing where, you know, you went to seminary, you got your MDiv and you took your place among the erudite, you know, among the sort of cultural elite. Well, those days are gone. I mean, being a pastor with an MDiv doesn't get you any credibility at the Rotary Club or something like that anymore. Like, nobody cares. So, and also the way that the church is working and functioning in the world is just not. Now, I'm an intellectual. I'm all for theological education. Love it. You know, believe in it. But as a qualification to do ministry or plant churches, that's not. It's not necessary at all, especially when you think of the church as this simpler thing, this essential thing, you know?
How about And we're all with you. I mean, we inward, outward, upward. I mean, yeah, worship, community, community mission. We're with you on that. What would you want to say to the pastor that's like, I think we have like 39 things instead of three. We've got way too many. And I would maybe even unpack the analogy of the Concorde jet. I'd love for you to just kind of talk a little bit about that. And like, how do we get to a point where we just like can't pull out anymore? What would you want to tell to the pastor who's actually built a Concorde jet church and doesn't want to do it anymore?
Well, you're referring to what's called the sunk cost fallacy or sunk cost bias. You know, there's also something called endowment theory. This is what my wife has when she's trying to sell an old dryer or something, and she thinks this dryer is worth a lot. You know, someone should pay $200 for this. And it's like, pretty sure you can get a new dryer for $300. So that's, no one's going to buy our old rickety, rusty dryer, you know, but it's ours. And it's been very useful to us. And because we own it, and because we have history with it, we overvalue it. That's what happens. That's the endowment effect, that actually we overestimate the value of a thing that's in our possession. And the sunk cost bias, of course, you know, the it's just the idea that once we, well, this happened to my son. I'm sorry to throw my family under the bus here, but he bought this motorcycle. He keeps wrecking it. And so like the, you know, front end's broken, the headlights fell off, all this stuff. And he can't really, he keeps putting money into trying to keep it running, and he keeps dumping so much money. So he's put triple the value of the bike into it over and over again. And he just can't stop because I've already put so much money in that I feel like I've got to keep going with this thing. You know, this is what you call behavioral economics. You know, the sort of predictably irrational, that extraordinary book where we're not being rational anymore. We're not thinking actually the best thing to do is just stop spending money on this bike. You know, but it feels like we've already spent so much money that to stop would be foolish or a waste, but actually, no, you have to stop. You need to stop. And yeah, I'm sure for some of our systems, we know they don't work. We don't even really like them anymore, but God, I put my whole life into this, or I'm 30 years into the ministry now, and I don't know what else to do. It just feels really hard to just turn back or turn away from that. I don't know what I would say to people in that category, except, you know, see reason. I don't know. Save yourself there. You know. I suppose there is a kind of liberation or a kind of joy that comes from being liberated. And you won't really know that until you just let go. And maybe all spiritual disciplines are somehow powered by surrender, you know? So it's okay. Just let go, you know? I've been telling a story recently of a fire that took place in 1949, a place called Man Gulch, Montana. And it's one of these kind of explosive sweeping fires that came through this canyon. And so they had to drop in these 23, I think, elite firefighters. It's 1949. So they parachute in. They call them smoke jumpers. And, you know, they have all these kind of tools on their back, axes and shovels and stuff in these packs. But the fire, these kinds of fires move so fast. They're so vicious that sometimes they can just get on you. Something like they move at something like 11 feet per second.
Wow.
You can imagine that. And so in this particular, this is a famous fire. And in this particular fire, the foreman of the crew of the smoke jumpers, a guy called Wagner Dodge, which is an amazing fireman name. he gave the order to all the smoke jumpers to drop their tools and run, to run for your life, basically run up this ravine to escape this oncoming fire. Like it was too close. And three or four of them obeyed the order and dropped their tools and survived. The rest of them would not put down their tools, and the fire consumed them. They died. Now, this became important because actually this happened like three or four more times in kind of the history of firefighting, these kind of fires where people are given orders to drop their tools, won't. They just won't. Like psychologically, they can't for some reason. And this has become of interest to social scientists because it's a question of why we can't drop our tools. Like why, even at on threat of death, we can't put them down for some reason. And of course, that idea of dropping your tools is proxy for unlearning what you guys brought up earlier. It's an issue of like, we're too psychologically invested in it. Their sunk cost is so high for us that we don't even know why. Like there was a guy called Quentin Rhodes in 1994 that was in a similar fire in Colorado. And he actually ran for like 900 feet with his chainsaw in his hand and finally was like, what am I doing? You know? And then he thought in his head, I need to put this down. But he kept thinking the whole time, I don't want to, I can't. And he, as he's running for his life, he was thinking, this was in the sort of victim incident report. As he was running for his life, he kept thinking, I need to find a safe place to put this. They found people in that fire with chainsaws melted, burned into their dead hands. You know, they just couldn't let go, you know? And man, if that is not a metaphor for people in ministry, long-term ministry, I don't know what is, because it's just hard to lay it down. Even when you know that you're supposed to, that you have to, that the thing may not survive if you don't, there's a psychological barrier to doing it. But, you know, I suppose what I'm saying is that you can, there's a kind of happiness or joy or life or, you know, like newness actually that can come upon your calling when you find yourself standing there without those tools anymore, kind of naked and thinking, okay, who am I now without my chainsaw or without my axe or whatever? Well, you know, you're a son or daughter of God. You're a called person. You know, you're a priest in this royal priesthood. Which is all you ever were that mattered anyway, you know?
I mean, there's so many stories like NASA pulling the plug on stuff. I mean, I think of Canoeing the Mountains, Todd Bolsinger's book, right? We know canoeing, we got to leave it behind because you can't canoe mountains. And the Concord Jet story of like jumping so much money that you mentioned in your book when you talked about the Concord Jet story, that even though it was just years and years of, we know this is losing money, but we're a point of no return. At some point, there were engineers that said, we need to stop this. There's some courageous people within the system of Concord that said, no more, we're done. And I think if Doug and I are hearing you right, it's saying we need to be those kinds of people that are dropping chainsaws and going to the bosses and saying, the Concord Jet, like, no more. We've got to cut this. So how would we know, Brian? Of course, we need wisdom, but how would we know what we keep and what we don't, right? So because there are some helpful tools. You know, for example, your three ecclesial minimum elements are like, great. Those should not be abandoned, but other tools should be. So how might we navigate with wisdom of knowing, you know, the firefighters didn't drop their shoes either. They still ran with shoes and clothes on, right? But they dropped the heavy tool. So how would we know the balance between what's an axe or a chainsaw and what are our shoes as we're running? Does that make sense?
Yeah. I mean, my answer to that question is we have to get back to being missionaries, you know, missionary people. You know, what drives the missionary is, you know, well, it's twofold, isn't it? It's intimacy with God. So like a missionary life is hard. You know, you don't make any money and nobody likes you. And, you know, it's just like a lot of suffering. And so what drives the missionary person is this deep intimacy and connection with God. Like, I'm doing what he's asked me to do. And that's, man, you can't put a price on that. Mm. Like that sense of destiny or significance or purpose that only can come from the Father, you know. But the other thing is the people you're called to. Like, what do they need? Mm-hmm. What would serve them? What would reach them? What would bless them? What would communicate or bear witness to the kingdom in their life? And you kind of do anything to do that, to get there. Mm-hmm. You know, it's in missionary terms, it's contextualization. It's like, how do I make the gospel accessible? How do I make the goods of the kingdom, the sacramental life of the people of God, accessible to these people who don't know Jesus or who are far from him or who suffer in great need? That's what matters. You know, that's what drives you. So then you think, okay, well, does this tool help me do that? You know, does this building or this way of doing finances or these staff roles or whatever, if they don't help us do that, then okay. Like, why are we hanging on to them? Mm-hmm. I mean, getting back to that sort of apostolic, focus, that's what should drive a kingdom minded person. It's the kind of coming of the kingdom, you know, the Lord's Prayer, that his kingdom would come, that his will would be done on earth as it is in heaven. Man, I was just thinking about Mark, is it Mark 7 today, where Jesus says, he's given it to the Pharisees, you know, and he says, you've let go of the commands of God and you're holding on to human traditions. And those two images pop up in my head, you know, like, letting go and holding on, like the tool thing, right? It's like you let go of the commands of God and you hold on to human traditions. And then he's sort of like snarky, you know, he says, you have a fine way of setting aside the commands of God so you can observe your own traditions, you know? So it's like, look, we're holding on to certain things and we're letting go of certain things. But hold on to the right things and let go of the right things. You know, the tools, the traditions, I know they mean something to us, but it's okay to let go of them and hold fast to the commission, to the calling that we've received, you know? Isn't that really what change management is? What you let go of and what you hold on to? And actually the people aren't so much afraid of change as they are afraid of loss. Mm-hmm. You know, the problem people have with change is not, they think it's change like on the surface, but actually it's about feeling like I'm losing something. I don't want to lose Betsy, my favorite chainsaw, you know? But actually what you stand to lose is much greater. In this, you know, Jesus's case, he's saying the commands of God, you know, like, You held on to something, but you let go of the more important thing. You know?
Yeah. Brian, I think that's really helpful. So I think the thing that keeps coming to my mind is like, what is the mindset of a firefighter who listens to that command to let go and run and does that? Like, what are those? Like, how does he situate, or how does she situate herself in a position to just be ready to drop and run at any given moment?
I mean, what do you think? I don't know. I to me, it's just that surrendered life. Like, we're not attached, you know, like it feels like some sort of ancient commitment that the almost monastic, you know, where we don't allow ourselves to be attached to worldly things, you know, and, you know, in our rush, you know, in the late 90s and early aughts, in our rush to be culturally relevant, you know, to be kind of cool or whatever. We may have forsaken just kind of holiness, you know, the desire to be able to be in the presence of God without guilt, you know. And holiness and you know, my understanding of kind of those deep monastic sort of disciplines or whatever has a lot to do with attachment, you know, and not loving the world so much, you know, mm-hmm. and not even loving your life more than you love the kingdom mm-hmm. and the hope of the kingdom. And I think as a missionary person, the people he sent you to, mm-hmm. like you would die essentially for those yeah. people mm-hmm. and for him who called you. You know, I think it's Jürgen Moltmann that says, you know, before Jesus doesn't just die on a cross for us, he dies on a cross for his Father. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. like he first dies for the Father because he asked him to. You know, that's what happens in Gethsemane. Mm-hmm. It's an agreement between the two of them, you know. So yes, he dies for the world. Yes, he dies for us. And in that suffering, we're free, you know. And it becomes a model, really, for engagement mm. in the world. Mm. Not just incarnation, but crucifixion is a model for engagement, right? Mm. Cruciformity, you know that. But he dies for the Father before he dies for the people, you know? Mm. And same with us. It's like to look upon the face of God as best we can and to be so fascinated, so enraptured, so in love, actually, that the other things don't matter. They don't matter.
I love that. Yeah, it reminds me of one of the greatest American missionary movements with the Moravians, which is just about 45 minutes north of us in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. And Count Nicholas von Zinzendorf, which is also an amazing name.
It's a good name.
John Tyson and I did a tour of the original Moravian enclave there, which is fascinating. But you know, one of the greatest Zinzendorf quotes for me is he said, "Preach the gospel, die, be forgotten."
Wow.
You know, we talk about cruciformity, right? Like, you know, preach the gospel, die, be forgotten. And yet, yet we still remember him today because that's how he lived of a forgotten life. Yet we can't forget someone who lives in that forgotten state. So, anyway, yeah. So as we talk about mission, mission, of course, is the sharp tip of the arrow and it's essential in all of this. And I love how you don't allow any micro church to start without mission being the driving area, not just a huddle and cuddle affinity group. But, you know, we've been around mission oriented leaders. I coach a lot of them. A lot of them are great practitioners, but I see an alarming amount of kingdom practitioners with good hearts, but they're exhausted and burned out, almost addicted to adrenaline. So what are some of the practices that you do that keep you from burning out? What healthy practices do you cultivate for a flourishing with God life? Knowing it's not perfection, but how are you still in the game after all these years?
You're assuming a lot there. You're assuming that I'm not burning out. Practices. Yeah. I mean, I'm listening, you know, to the sort of voices in the church saying, you know, to care for our soul and Sabbath and, you know, prioritize, you know, rest, you know, recreation, you know, actually doing things that bring life to you and that sort of thing. But I also think it is partly how we view it. I mean, fundamentally how we view the work we're called to do and, you know, that whole kind of goofy bumper sticker saying, you know, if you find something you love, you never work a day in your life, you know. I do think ministry can be like that. Even when you're in the midst of kind of a hard time or suffering, you still feel like, I love this. You know, I love what I'm called to do and the people that I'm called to. And so, you know, to me, burnout is probably more related to an inner reality than an externalized reality. So when we just try to sort of adjust things like our calendar or our schedule, you know, we have a policy. We send everyone on a sabbatical every 7 years. And, you know, I've sent and supervised plenty of people that go on sabbaticals and they come back and their bodies are rested, but their souls aren't. Like they're still cooked, you know, there's nothing left in the tank. Like that did not get replenished or they're still fragile. You know, they're like on a hair's trigger again. Because you know, you can rest, you can have those kind of rhythms, but if the way you see what you do, is not something that's life giving, it's kind of like a cognitive, sort of, I don't know, commitment, it's a worldview, I guess. And part of it is just that, I would say for me, part of it is the reason why I'm still in the game is because I knew suffering was going to be part of it. Like you sort of brace yourself, you steel yourself for that. And you don't feel hurt or offended by God when it happens. You don't think something has gone wrong, you know, when the wheels come off. You think, well, you know, here we are. You know, what is it Acts 13 where Paul comes back through, I think, Lystra and Tyre, and it's almost like he forgot to appoint leaders. So in the first way through, so he's like, oh yeah, shoot, I need to. So he comes back through and he lays hands, and I think it's the first and only time we have them kind of ordaining elders. And all he says in that sort of ordination ceremony, so to speak, there is, it takes many hardships to enter the kingdom of God. So that's what it means to be ordained as an elder. It's just saying, listen, guys, it's not going to be glory. You know, if you want to be a leader in the church, it's not going to be about glory. It's going to be about hardships, because that's how the kingdom comes. Blood, sweat, and tears, you know? Mm. And I think for me, that maybe is a kind of secret, an inner secret, that I have a good, strong theology of suffering. That doesn't mean it doesn't hurt me, and it doesn't mean it doesn't take my breath away when it happens. And I don't need time and space to recover from being winded. But I do think I'm protected and preserved to some degree, because, you know, I can almost hear the voice of God saying, what did you think was going to happen? You know, what did you think I called you into? As Paul on the Damascus road, you know, or Ananias, him saying, don't worry, Ananias, I'll show him how much he must suffer for my name's sake. It's like, wow, what a great job offer. Thanks, Lord. But, you know, this, and what does Paul end up saying? He says, I want to know Christ and the fellowship and his suffering, so somehow to attain his resurrection. Like, man, this is like the secret of intimacy, actually, with him. Mm-hmm. It's hard. This life is hard, but it's totally worth it. Totally worth it.
Mm-hmm. Brian, this has been a conversation that we knew would be full, and we knew would go quickly and would be rich. So thanks for what you're doing. Thanks for your teaching, your writing, and just modeling what a missionary mindset looks like, and jet setting around the world and just saying, God, what's next? And that's great. So thanks for this conversation. We really appreciate it.
Good talking to you guys.
You too, Brian.
Doug, I thoroughly enjoy that conversation with Brian.
Yes, I agree with you fully. So, dude, what a smart guy. Like, I'm just trying to keep up. It's like he's quoting books and all kinds of, I'm like, this guy is extremely well-read. But even beyond that, I just get the sense of it was so nice to talk to a pioneer, one who's been thinking through the stuff that you and I have been thinking through for quite a few years too, but just is a little, it seems like he's a little further down the road. Yeah. So much good stuff. So what things jumped off the page for you, JR?
Well, I think three P's come to mind when I think about Brian in this interview. He was prophetic, right? There were some things that made us uncomfortable and probably made our listeners uncomfortable, but he was also pastoral, of bringing us back to the heart of God and to the ways of God. But he was also practical. You know, he is a practitioner, and that's what I love. He does not talk from some ivory tower of theory. It's very practical. I mean, he's lived in intentional community for 20 years. He has never just lived his family. Like, he always has people living with him in the midst of this. He lives and journeys with his team. So I think those three P's stick out to me. But, you know, talking about the Concord Jet story, and then he told an even better story about the Man Gulch, the fire out west in 1949 with Wagner Dodge. Like, I love that name, Wagner Dodge. That sounds like, I don't know, like maybe that's a, you know, Mia, I love potential band names, like the Wagner Dodge Band. Like, that would be sweet. But anyway, just the idea of like dropping your tools, and the idea of like just melted chainsaw metal in the hands of dead bones. Like, man, that image is going to stick with me, which certainly makes me wonder, like, man, like, what chainsaws do I have to let go of in the midst of this? So, but you talked a lot about change theory, you know, the idea of people don't fear change, they fear loss.
Yeah.
And that I think can be really helpful for us as pastors in a season where there's been so much loss, and to say, if we call people to change, we need to help cast a clearer picture. But at the same time, we also need to make sure that we're acknowledging and allowing people to grieve what could be lost or what will be lost in the midst of the change. Mm. So Doug, what about you? What stuck out to you?
Oh my gosh. Yeah. The whole thing. But if I had to I think the thing that really resonated with me, just as I'm re-repairing or preparing for sabbatical this summer, is the statement where he said, burnout is more inner than outer. Yeah. That stung a bit. And I'm probably going to have to sit with that a little bit more. But even just recognizing the importance of, I think he's right in that, how do we kind of get our mindset around suffering and even just expecting that, but also, like, what does it look like to keep developing the intimacy with God? And I wonder too, if my sense is missionaries, people with missionary mindset, burnout looks a little different than people who are pastoring congregations that are a little bit more traditional, or sort of the model of church that many of us were, you know, brought up, raised in, pastor now, brought up in. And I just think about how burnout probably looks really differently for our wiring and our giftedness. And so pastors may feel a little different, prophets, apostles, different things like that. So that was really interesting. And just really, and I think too, even just the end part of our conversation about how, you know, all of us are, you know, like we should expect a moral failure in all of our lives. And that's kind of like I don't want to hear that. But it's hard to get away from scripture and not see the moral failings of the people over all the pages of scripture. Yeah. And so, I think just sitting with that today, or, you know, for the next few days, probably just in terms of, I think one of the most important things is like, who are the people in my life that know me deeply enough that can help me sort of sniff that out and recognize when sin is at the door. So those are the things that I was really, the Mangold, I mean, dude, Wagner Dodge, that is like, if I had another kid, it'd be Wagner Dodge Moister. Like, I'm going to say that right now. I love that name. That is like the coolest name in the world.
Doug, you have complete permission at any point recording in the future to call me Wagner Dodge.
Okay. Yes. Yeah. Awesome.
You're more than welcome. If you say, Wagner, what do you got? Like, I'll totally respond to Wagner, Mr. Dodge, anything. So, the idea of moral failing, like, you know, we sort of see that as code word for, you know, like something terrible, embezzlement, you know, sexual affair, but isn't all sin moral failing? Right. You really helped me. That was a question I had never fully asked before on that language. He had a moral failure. Well, I have moral failures every day. Mm. Like, that was a fascinating, that was really helpful for me.
Yeah.
But I think what was helpful, you know, just his view of ecclesiology is going to be very different and maybe radical for some of us as we think about this. But, you know, I really appreciated, you know, in the book, and I'll just do a quick quote from the book that we didn't have time to ask him about, but he said this in his book, Underground Church. He said, I often ask a group of pastors, if you had to decide today to have either a church of 1,000 people who come together on Sunday, but never more than 100 in active mission in the world, or a church of 1,000 on active mission, but never more than 100 in the same room at the same time, which would you choose? And he said, sadly, even though most of us admit that the latter is better for the kingdom, many still choose the former. Until this changes in the hearts of our leaders, I'm sure we will have neither the courage nor the will to make the necessary changes. But if we continue to forge ahead and make the changes, I'm also confident that God will give us both the courage and the will. Man, I think that's a lot of what he's talking about, that putting down a big room full of people is one of our chainsaws, right? For many pastors. But I love that he talked about ecclesiology. How did he stay in the game? He had a missionary mindset. Surrender. He kept using the word surrender. And he talked about having a theology of suffering, something that you and I have talked about, something that's very important, something I articulated in the the book I wrote called Fail, but the idea of expect suffering. And you talk about Acts 13 and the hardship, that was great. But I want to read again, just briefly, if I could, Doug, the Mark 7 verse that he talked about.
Yeah, please.
You know? And that's chainsaw stuff, right? I mean, he talked about, he said, having no regard for the command of God, you hold fast to human tradition. Jesus speaking to the Pharisees, having no regard for the command of God, you hold fast to human tradition. Whoa. Yeah, that's, yikes. You know, there's a lot there. What do we take up? What do we hold fast to? And what do we let go of? Yeah. I won't think about that verse and change theory the same again. The kingdom of God is all about change theory. Yeah. That's what this is about.
Yeah.
So
Wagner Dodge will pop right into your head, dude. I mean, seriously, but that's where I think it really comes back to, I think, to multiple conversations we've had, but specifically Sky Jatani.
Yeah.
Just that question of like, what is church? Like, we're in a season where as pastors, we are invited into asking that question again and discovering afresh and anew what that is. And I think that that's such, it can be terrifying. Or it can be exhilarating. And I think maybe a little bit of both is probably a good thing for us as pastors, just to come back to it. Like, what are these minimum pieces? Like, where do we find ourselves just saying, yes, Lord, this is like, if this is what you're calling us to, man, I'm in, like, I'm in, whatever that would be.
Yeah. But, yeah. That's my brother calls that terracitement, or being terracited.
Terracited. And,
he says, so much of our involvement in the kingdom is being terracited.
That's good.
That there's a little bit of fear of what is required of me, but there's so much excitement of anticipation. It's a beautiful portmanteau, two words becoming one on that. So let's leave people with questions, resources, and then we'll send people out here. So a couple of questions, Doug, that you and I talked about just as we were listening to Brian speak. Number one, what are the tools that are the hardest for us to let go? What are our chainsaws that we need to let go of? And then number two, what is your ecclesial minimum? I know Brian talked about worship, community, and mission, but in reality, not just the what's the right answer for the test, but in your life, in your church, in your context, what is your ecclesial minimum in reality? So we want to encourage you to wrestle with those two questions. Doug, what would be some good resources that we can recommend?
Two of his books, Micro Churches and Underground Church, fantastic reads. And again, I appreciate the way that Brian even talked about Tampa Underground, not as like, this is the model that works, but this is Netscape now, you know, this is Navigator. This is something that we hope is built upon. And so even checking out the website, tampaunderground.com, I think would just be a good opportunity if you want to kind of see what is happening and what's going on there. I think that would be a great resource as well.
Yeah. Well, pastors, listeners, we're so grateful for you. We want to send you out with this as a final charge, just as we are near the end of 2020. As you go, we bless you and we thank God for you. But we also want to encourage you, just as Brian said, that may you go with a missionary mindset, not as spectators, but as participants wanting to involve other participants in God's kingdom. May you surrender. May you drop your chainsaws. And may you focus your life on the ecclesial minimum of worship, community, and mission. May you embrace a theology of suffering. May we listen to Paul's words in Acts 13 that we would expect suffering. And more than all of that, even in the midst of our suffering, would we experience joy in the midst of it all. God bless, and bless God.